At 22 and a half past the hour, we're in touch with Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist and a member of the Board of Creation Moments, also a vineyard. I keep forgetting what you tell me. Vineyard and vintner, you do both? Or are they the same thing, Don?
No, they're two different things. Okay. A vigneron manages a vineyard, and a vintner makes wine.
Okay, well, you do both, so both will be on your business card then. You're going to need a bigger card. I mean, biochemist, member of the board. I know you spent, and you're a dad, and land management there. I mean, running a grape ranch is a lot of work. The irrigation systems, sensors, and tanks and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, well, last year I put a list together of all the skills it requires to run a business like this, and it was quite a long list.
Shipping clerk is on there, and receiving clerk, and accountant, and
the guy that makes the labels.
Yeah.
The label design. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's graphics design.
Well, he's a talented guy, but we're zeroing in on his experience as a biochemist today. And over the years, now Don's been with us for 7.5 years, typically on a Tuesday morning. And we talk about matters scientific, and we talk about faith, and we talk about the biblical creation. And the topic today is DNA, and we've talked about DNA many times on the program. And this one goes back, this article is from New Scientist Daily Magazine. And the headline's an attention getter. It says, "Stupidity should be cured," says DNA discoverer. And one of the discoverers is James Watson, and his partner Francis Crick discovered the structure of DNA back in 1953. It was in February, so we're coming up on a kind of an anniversary of that. And he's got a rather odd idea there, Don. How does this relate to hubris, say?
Oh, well, yes. So... I guess the question here is, can one manipulate your genes in order to improve intelligence, for example? The bigger question is, where does intelligence come from? Is it, influenced by the environment or by your parents, or is it genetic, and how much of it is genetic, and then which genes are involved, and how do we go about manipulating the genes that may not be up to snuff, and those type of things? It's a it's an interesting question, but a very difficult problem to solve.
Tell me what the word genome means, because I know that just a few years ago there were efforts to harness together all the computing power from people who would volunteer the use of the computers, and there was some software somewhere that would put pieces of information together to identify or count or understand the human genome, which had yet to be accomplished. Now it's accomplished. What is a genome?
Well, a genome for a particular species, in this case for humans, is a library, if you will, of the complete DNA code, for that species. So when we, you get different genes, and you've got different...
They're all identified by a letter, right? There are only so many different genes in the genome. And I think they're identified by a letter of the alphabet, right?
Well, now you're going back down to the code, the DNA code. So it takes four nucleotide bases to code for a specific amino acid or a specific, let's start, this is where this gene starts or this is where the gene stops. Then, of course, with our genome, there's a lot of empty space between the genes. So the genes actually code for proteins, typically, they code for proteins. And then the proteins are either used for structural purposes, in your cells or in your body, like collagen, for example, would be a structural protein, or they code for enzymes or other functioning proteins like globular proteins or glycoproteins that have a bunch of sugars attached to them, or transport.
So you could call this maybe the operator's manual or the blueprint for the organism. Then it determines what happens when internally.
Right. It's the blueprint. So mm-hmm. it's the body's blueprint or the cell's blueprint for what it's going to make and how it makes it. In engineering terms, it would be, I got the schematic for, this electronic project, and therefore all I need to do is put together these various pieces. In this case, it's the blueprint for the various pieces, and then the machinery within the cell begins to assemble it with stuff that's already there, for example. You got to have the cell.
So your cell has all the raw ingredients, and then some little part of the cell reads the blueprint and says, aha, I need two parts of this and one part of this and three parts of this, puts it together, and somehow accomplishes that. We've talked from time to time about how busy a human cell is, any kind of cell, plant or animal, with information going on and little messenger critters, I don't know what else to call them, but it's immensely complicated. How then, when you look at DNA, do you determine what kind of DNA determines what kind of characteristic? It seems to me that if, for example, you wanted to identify the DNA that made for tall, you would have to go to a bunch of tall people and see what DNA they had in common. In other words, you would learn from the results of the DNA what the function of the DNA was. Is that accurate?
Somewhat accurate, because you would need both tall and short people, because you got to compare it against something. Then you look for commonality in the mm-hmm. differences between between the genes, for example. So if you're looking at the DNA is multifaceted and multi-level. So you got the code, which is, like I said, these four base pairs, make up a code that either identifies a particular amino acid that's going to be inserted into a protein, or you have control mechanisms like start and stop, and then there's these big regions that don't code for anything, but they're very much involved with gene expression. They used to call it junk DNA, but it's no longer junk DNA. They're finding out that, if you took that away, things wouldn't work right. So mm-hmm. they have a very big function on how the genes are expressed and which genes are expressed at any given point in time.
This reminds me of computer code. Now, I'm not a computer code guy. I've seen code written, and I've seen the results of code, and doing websites and things, there's certain kinds of code writing things, and there's a symbol that makes the computer do this or do that. This sounds very similar.
It is similar from the point of view that you need some type of you need instructions on what to make, and then if you get this input, you need this certain output, and therefore you need a certain code to be able to interpret the input and then convert it to the output that you want. Mm-hmm. So this is a molecular model of that. And then our cells are really manufacturing plants, very highly specialized, if you will, manufacturing plants, so complex that we couldn't even come close to replicating the manufacturing process within a cell. Now, we can make short peptides and even longer peptides in the laboratory, but how do you get it to fold in the correct orientation is still a problem, because that's part of the machinery of the cell. There are specific proteins, for example, that are folding proteins. And your DNA or your RNA, not RNA, your amino acid sequence that's coming out from this whole process then needs to be folded in the right manner for that particular protein to work properly.
Okay.
And
well,
that's so just, you've got these barrel proteins within the cell that manage that type of stuff. So it's a highly sophisticated, machine, molecular machine, if you will. And now to go back to the question of intelligence, we've got to somehow figure out, okay, which of these genes, and there are thousands, literally thousands and thousands of genes that code for the various proteins within your body, which of these genes then are responsible for intelligence? And that is a very difficult question because it winds up that it's not just a single gene. For example, like with sickle cell anemia, we know where the defect is in the protein. We know that a certain amino acid was replaced by a very conservative, another amino acid in sickle cell anemia for your blood proteins and your hemoglobin proteins, and at a certain pH, instead of being a ball or a disc structure, these proteins elongate. We know the gene that is responsible for that, but yet we have not even come close to being able to repair on a genetic level that particular disease. So now you're talking about intelligence, and there was a parallel article also mentioned in this particular article in the New Scientist that they're saying, well, in this past year we have identified probably 10% of the genes that are responsible for maybe intelligence. And so we went from 1% to 10%. That's a great accomplishment. But even with that, there are over 500 different genes that influence intelligence. So if we can't fix one gene, how are we going to fix 500 or 5,000 genes? it's a huge task to undertake, much less even conceptualize how one would go about doing that.
Now, how do scientists read DNA, or looking at the DNA from a person? Is it a computer generated graph, or a chart, or bands of color, or somehow they must be able to visually compare one set of genes with another, or is it a mathematical computation? How does that happen? Because what concerns me is then if they can say, well, this is the gene pattern of a low intelligence person, then they could compare that with the gene patterns of every other person and decide who should be targeted for elimination, or what genes need to be modified to eliminate stupidity. I mean, which at some point becomes very subjective. So this is a whole scary idea. But what is the representation of a gene pattern look like?
Well, they would do DNA analysis, and you've got to have a sample of the DNA of the person. I mean, you I don't know if you've taken the test, but
no, never have.
these tests, you send in a little saliva or something in a test tube, and you send it back to the company, and they run a DNA test, and they say, oh, you're 2% this, or you're 10% this, and 50% this. Here's your ethnicity, if you will. And most people find out that, hey, they're a mix of people. They're mixed people from different parts of the world. I mean, that's I think we knew that going in. But it is a It's an analytical, procedure. So it actually turns out to be various bands on a process called electrophoresis, okay. But a highly sophisticated electrophoresis that reads the bands and then determines, oh, okay, this is your genetic code, for example. But if you have thousands and thousands of genes, this can get quite complicated. And it's one thing doing a simple scan, but all of this is mechanized now.
Well, I would think there's a computer that reads these scans and then relays certain conclusions from what it reads in the data. In other words, yes. This is DNA for a person who is Caucasian and tall and from Western Europe or some such thing. But what if I send in my sample? How likely it is that I get back a letter that says, I'm sorry, we've read your DNA and we regret to inform you that you're stupid. You know, how likely is that to happen?
That would be disturbing if you didn't know it already, but that would be quite disturbing, to some people. But it's what you do with the information. It's one thing to say, well, okay, you fall in the upper 10% of the population in this particular area, or you fall into the lower 10% of the population in this area. But then what do you do with the information? That's the ethical question. Mm-hmm. Is it just interesting information and here this is what makes up the human race, or are you going to act on it? And if you are going to act on it and say, let's just take something that's relatively benign and say that those people who fall in the lower 10% of the intelligence spectrum, if you will, they cannot hold any type of job except for a menial task, flipping hamburgers or whatever it happens to be. They may be very skilled in certain types of activities, which they would then be excluded from because somebody in the bureaucratic system decided that, they can't do this because of their DNA test.
But that's already happened. And we do that now. And we self-select for those who go to college and get advanced degrees, and then most of them go to Washington, D.C., and form the seven counties around the capital, and that's a concentration of some of the highest intellect and the most educated, and so we're already self-selecting to do that, and the vast, or it's a preponderance, not all are there because there's some of us out here in the hinterlands as well. I'm not sure if I confessed this before, but I was at one time I was a member of Mensa, and I took the test and they allowed me to pay dues for a number of years. I forgot. I think it was $50 a year, and they let me go to they had conventions and parties and people with very thick glasses and the guys tended to wear their pants high up on their waist. And there was certain characteristics of these people that belonged to Mensa that I've never seen in general society other than that. But we already do that. I'm trying to think of the name of the writer who has written a number of books about intelligence. He's the guy who wrote The Bell Curve. You know who I'm talking about, and I've forgotten his name, but he has already said that, and it's in some of the, in fact, the book in The Bell Curve, it assigns that that intelligence has come about, or the lack of intelligence has come about, with many of the world's greatest not disabilities, but stratification in society. So yes. The stupidity is a relative term. I think what Watson was talking about is dealing with the clinically moronic, with those people with an IQ of between 30 and 50. Is there something that we can do for them that these people can just barely function?
Well, and that's... is there something that one can do? Like I said before, we can't even the diseases that we know, for example, have a very specific genetic source, we haven't been able to, you know, cure them via genetic manipulation. So now if you're talking about a specific disease like Down syndrome or something mm-hmm. like that, I mean, yeah, that's a genetic problem. It's a, you know, chromosomal issue. We have more chromosomes than you're supposed to have, or fragile X syndrome, for example, or phenylketonuria is another issue. And if we can solve those problems.
Well, Don, here's the essence of the question as I see it. If science can convince us that climate is changing and it's our fault, and this is the solution, and we need to rearrange world economies to save the future of the planet and the human race, how far away are we from a time when science, now God little g, can say we have a solution for stupid or short or violent or this disease or that disease, and simply sell the idea, and that allows us to accept it and permit them, you know, give them the authority to do it? That's the concern for me. It's really the propaganda power of science.
Well, it is, and science does not. We're not that smart, for example. I mean, we're not that smart to fix these problems. And so, what you're left with is, if you had a screening method that said, "Oh, you're going to be given the right conditions, you're going to be, you know, super intelligent," or given the, even under the best conditions, you're not going to achieve any more than this level, or this baby, for example, because once you get it down to a genetic level, now you can screen at the time of, a week or so after conception, we could then screen to say, okay, is this fetus going to turn into a smart person or a dumb person? And then the ethical question is, do we abort that baby because it's mm-hmm. not going to produce the type of the quality of person that we're looking for in society? I think that's a much more dangerous question and problem, and much more likely, you know, to happen as we lose our basis for who humans are in terms of, in the mind and sight of God, as opposed to we can just manipulate all of this stuff and it will be okay. So now we're purposefully, aborting babies. I mean, we're doing it in some areas. They're trying to screen for various diseases and saying, oh, you know, you're going to have a Down syndrome baby, so therefore let's go ahead and abort it now, as opposed to, no, let's have the baby and then we'll deal with the consequences of that child, because human life is valuable. Once you go down the path of making decisions as to who lives and who doesn't live, you're basically, you know, obviously playing God, but you then have crossed over into a very dangerous situation where somebody is making a decision as to who lives and who doesn't.
See, and you say somebody, there's the crux of it, because even if science did have the power to do it flawlessly, there are other non-scientific organizations, people, groups who would take full advantage of that and abuse it, abuse the knowledge that science has developed. And I think that happens all the time. And they do it for profit. They do it for power. So it's the marriage of science with unscrupulous human beings, with fallen man, that is the real threat, I think, not science itself.
Well, not the pure science, because the pure science is giving us information. What we do with the information then is up to us. But if you have no ethical basis to make decisions, then that's a very dangerous and slippery slope.
Now you're at the crux, the basis for making these decisions, the ethical standard. You and I both know where that comes from.
Yes. And, you know, for us, it comes from outside this universe, you know. So, but that's not the case, you know, for a lot of people these days.
Mm-hmm. The well, you know, we do that as well, and maybe the most benign case is what are referred to as designer babies, and I'm wondering, and I've only heard the term, and I'm not interested in getting one myself, so I've not really looked into it all that much. But it's not to the point of looking at the kid and saying, If this kid has a disease, a genetic disease of some sort, you abort the child. But there's some way to do an operation or do a genetic manipulation while the child is in the womb. Are you up on that? I don't know.
I haven't heard of anything, you know, necessarily like that. There have been some cloning experiments, mm-hmm. you know, live. I think China has experimented with that. Other people in Europe may have been experimenting, you know, with that, where they produced a human baby clone. But that, even that is different. It's taking the DNA from one person and then let's say in a fertilized egg, for example, you take out the DNA at the time of fertilization, and then you put in the DNA from, you know, another person into that egg, and so you've effectively have cloned, you know, that person. Mm-hmm. But in the process, you've destroyed, you know, the other person, because you've taken out their DNA, you've taken out the machinery, the coding for the machinery as to who that person was. So those type of experiments have been done, and there's been a lot of, outcry against that, because that's it's an ethical question. But to actually go in and say, okay, I'm going to make a totally new person, and I want to mix the DNA from these very smart people together, here's the characteristics that I want. I want the person to be a super athlete, so we take the DNA from a super athlete. I want the person to be super intelligent, so you take the DNA from a super intelligent person, and you mix them all together. And voila, you come up with this super person.
You're talking about a DNA cookbook.
A DNA cookbook.
Yeah. A couple of comments.
Yes.
comments from a listener here. They write that Gardner, and I'm not sure, they don't remember the first name, but has researched and developed a theory of multiple intelligences. In other words, not just one characteristic of intelligence, mm-hmm. in varying degrees, but different kinds of intelligence, verbal or numeric, and so many other aptitudes, I suppose you could call them, that
musical, artistic.
Yeah, that further complicates the whole intelligence question.
Yeah. Now there's hundreds of different kinds of intelligences,
mm-hmm. and then also
not just intellectual.
That Iceland is working toward eradication of Down syndrome by screening all pregnancies and aborting those with defective, in quotes, defective pregnancies.
There you go. That's the
problem. It started. Who decides what's defective and how much power do we relinquish to them, you know, from the moral authority that we get outside of science, by the way. And that brings to mind the Creation Moments website. CreationMoments.com is the website. You can go there and find scientific information that supports the biblical story of creation, and the word DNA is not mentioned in the Bible, by the way. And I'm feeling kind of good about that. I'm kind of glad that's the case. And we appreciate so much, Don, your expertise and your visit every Tuesday morning here on Broken Road Radio. Don Clark, again, a biochemist, a member of the board of CreationMoments.com. And again, their website, CreationMoments.com. You can link to it from the Broken Road Radio site. Don, thanks for joining us today. We'll look forward to next week, okay?
All right. Very good. You folks have a great week.
Bye-bye.
See you, Don.
So long.
Bye.